Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story. An epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen.
Season 3, Episode 15, The Fair Castle on the Rock. The English and French, Richard and Philip, were trying to make peace yet again. But their tortured treaty, which required German approval, died shortly after it was born, just as the French had feared. Philip then took it upon himself to jump the port of Dieppe, one of Richard's more lucrative possessions. The two were fully back at it, on and on, throughout the later summer and into the fall of 1195, a time that supposedly was to be free of war in Europe so everyone could focus yet again on war in the Outremer. Richard covered a 3 days march in 24 hours to catch Philip at Issoudun, on the jumbled, troubled Norman border, about 150 miles south-southwest of Paris. To this day, the main thing that ever happened in this little place was Lionheart's attack in 1195. He had moved his army with the dashing speed he was famous for, catching Philip out. The French barons solemnly advised their king that a truce would be worthwhile, so the two monarchs are said to have ridden out together, helmets off, into a field where they talked for a time. At the end, or so we're told, they exchanged the kiss of peace, remounted, and rode back to announce with all due ceremony that the Christmas holidays would indeed be cheerful. They had, at last, agreed man to man that they would fight no more. In January 1196, they signed a treaty at Louviers that basically set each of them back in the lands held before the fighting had first started, with Philip the apparent gainer, since he won Richard's concession of Plantagenet claims to the coveted Vexin. Peace lasted a season at best. The new flashpoint wasn't all that new. Brittany. If you recall, Richard's legitimate brother Geoffrey had been installed as the local grandee by Henry Plantagenet. Geoffrey died unexpectedly in Paris to Philip Augustus's apparent desolation. A few months later, Geoffrey's wife Constance gave birth to a son, little Arthur. Richard had then surprised everyone by declaring Arthur his heir in the heady days when Lionheart was turning the Mediterranean into a Plantagenet pond. Now 9 years old, Arthur of Brittany, along with his beautiful older sister Eleanor, were of interest to several heads of state. And in the spring of 1196, Uncle Richard took it into his head to gather up the slack reins of his overlordship of Brittany. The children's mother, Constance, was directed to attend Lionheart's court, where she would presumably come into rare contact with her second husband, the product of another of Henry Plantagenet's matchmaking efforts, which never had love, but always had Plantagenet strategizing at their core. That noble marriage, entering its second frosty decade, had entirely to do with the location of her groom's lands on Brittany's border.
The husband, Ranulf de Blondeville, Earl of Chester, lived his life in England, while she lived in Brittany with her children, neither of which were his. For some bizarre reason in that troubled spring of 1196, he attacked her caravan as she was dutifully making her way to Richard. The perplexed Bretons, reluctant citizens of the Plantagenet Empire at best, were infuriated by this Plantagenet vassal's aggression against their noble family. Brittany immediately petitioned Philip Augustus for aid. He promptly rose to the occasion, taking advantage of the furore by urging the Bretons to demand freedom from Richard's grip. Richard responded as Richard usually did. He invaded Brittany. Little Arthur, in turn, was snatched up by French sympathizers and delivered to Philip, who promptly and publicly gave him asylum against his Plantagenet uncle. It's probably needless to remark that the Bretons no longer had the slightest use for the Plantagenets. More fighting followed as inevitably as day follows night, with unreliable fortune smiling on the French, particularly at Umal, another Norman village thrown into the jaws of war. Richard was rarely outclassed on a battlefield, but he was this time, deep in the heated summer of 1196, thanks to a new pact between the Flemish and the French. Lionheart ended having to ransom his Norman garrison to the tune of some 3,000 silver marks, and the French then wrecked the place. Nonnacourt, drowsing off to the south, was next to go. During another petty little fight that summer, Richard, who had lived his life on 1,000 battlefields with seldom as much as a nick, had his luck glance away for a second. He was wounded, hit in the knee by a crossbow bolt. We read about crossbows all the time in medieval warfare and pay little mind, but those so-called bolts were fearsome arrowheads made of hammered iron that could measure up to 4 inches across. Even quietly sleeping on a museum shelf, a crossbow bolt looks like it could do serious harm to an ox. Taking one in the knee had to knock anyone to the ground in screaming pain. This one did enough damage to Lionheart that it was a month before he could do more than hobble around. Laid up for weeks, enduring daily fussing by the surgeons, Richard had time to think. Normandy was the critical battleground between the Plantagenets and the Capets. Both sides desperately wanted to control it, its wealth, its manpower, its towns and farms, its rivers, its proximity to England on one side and Paris on the other. All of these advantages had long belonged to the Plantagenets. However, Normandy's capital, Rouen, one of Richard's most important cities, was alarmingly exposed to the French. The place had grown up over the centuries along a key road north from Paris, a mere 80 miles away. Rouen was also bisected by the Seine. It was, in short, a powerful Plantagenet base, but one equally subject to French attack by land and by water. Indeed, the French had just recently, if unsuccessfully, besieged the city, driven off thanks to the military skill of the Earl of Leicester. Richard now determined that he would make his Norman capital into a battleship of a forward base for himself. He would build a castle like no castle that had ever been seen. Lionheart had spent his entire life laying siege to castles, and he was going to throw everything he had ever seen, everything he had ever learned, into his fantastic construction. The site Richard chose was a cliff above the little town of Andely, a village upstream of Rouen that dated back 600 years even in Richard's time. The place had been settled at a very tight bend in the Seine, beneath 300-foot white cliffs that loomed like giants forever chained above the great river. One cliff in particular is shaped like the prow of a boat, attached by a thin strip of land to the plateau behind. Richard would build his fortress
on that cliff. Coming upon Richard's creation, the Castle of the Rock, Chateau Gaillard, the Brazen Castle, as he sometimes called it with mocking pride, is like stumbling over the remains of a nuclear power plant somehow conceived and built by human beings in a mere 2 years near the end of the 12th century. It was tough enough to endure another 4 centuries of warfare against its walls, and to this day it's a noble sight, even if sorely diminished from its original grandeur. To reduce Gaillard to its simplest terms, 3 huge segments were built one behind the next, each enclosed within stone walls, each set of walls in turn protected by a tremendous dry moat. Walls were no less than 8 feet thick and 30 feet high. Towers reinforcing the walls were 11 feet thick, solid stone. Moats, left dry, were 30 feet wide and 40 feet deep. Because of the way the ground sloped, the innermost third segment was 20 feet above the second, forcing attackers to fight their way uphill. Richard thought of everything. The most exposed gate in the outermost wall wasn't at the front of the place, but off to the side, at the back of a dry moat and guarded by a drawbridge. To get to it, you'd need to make it past at least 2 towers in the perimeter, not to mention endure constant fire from a tower built specifically to protect the gate. Assuming you could get through this outer gate, you'd stare across a huge courtyard at a second set of equally formidable walls with their own protective towers and moat. If you somehow made it past them, you'd be in a third courtyard where you would see something no one had ever seen before. Behind its own moat was a third wall, built not straight and true as every fortification wall in the world was built, but of abutting arcs, like a series of milk bottles joined one to the next. There was no place to get a grip on those curving walls, no blind spots where attackers could develop force, especially as archer slits were cut at each joint, giving bowmen a 180-degree field while protecting them from almost any line of return fire. Even if invaders somehow overcame everything else, the beating heart of Chateau Gaillard, the keep at the very back of the entire fortress, boasted walls 11 feet thick that sloped outward at the bottom. This clever architecture would protect the walls from tower-based attacks, where wooden structures built to the height of the besieged wall were wheeled to the wall's base. The towers were filled with infantry and archers, all panting for the moment they could drop a bridge onto the top of the targeted wall and tumble out to confront the thin line of defenders strung out single file along the narrow rampart. Gaillard's sloping wall footings kept these threats well back, making direct attack virtually impossible. Richard's keep also incorporated machicolations, a Muslim advance Richard had apparently seen in Syria, which allowed defenders to pour anything from arrows to boiling lead through holes in the floor onto anyone coming up from below. The keep had its own separate well, dug through hundreds of feet of stone, and a door that could only be reached by a rope ladder, quickly reeled in if threatened. Rather charmingly, in the midst of all this medieval might, a nice little lodging house was built for the castellan of the chateau, graced with handsome 36-pane windows and built-in stone benches on either side. If anyone had the energy to make their way up there, not forgetting several feather pillows to soften the seating, the view was spectacular. The whole thing was a true marvel of invention, engineering, and construction. One historian says that Gaillard, so carefully planned, so intricate, so perfectly expressive in its purpose on this earth, was a mathematical gem with the lovely symmetry of a Bach cantata. If Richard's great fortress echoed Bach's beauty, it also mirrored Bach's sinew. Untold ton upon ton upon ton of stone and wood had to be hauled in, and construction debris hauled out by cart. The 21st century mind falters when comprehending exactly how many cartloads that would be. So many laborers, so much food, and so much material were needed for the project that the little village of Andelay doubled in size with the construction of so-called Petit Andelay next door. Both heavily fortified themselves, posts sunk into the bottom of the Seine to block river access. Richard's masterpiece, built for war, came out fighting even before the first stone was laid. Under the terms of their short-lived January peace, neither Richard nor Philip were even to consider fortifying what was one of the most compelling strategic sites along the Seine. So Philip's displeasure at the abundant evidence that Richard was doing just that was intense. In addition to launching plans for their own massive fortification on Paris's western flank, the French set out to vent their ill temper by finding a fight. They beat the English in a bloody little skirmish near Andelay. Richard, in turn, thought to check his dungeons, finding three extremely unfortunate Frenchmen whose lives were reduced to objects to be tossed off the top of his cliff. 15 of their countrymen had their eyes put out, after which they limped back to Paris under the guidance of the proverbial one-eyed survivor. Philip Augustus, equally savage if less imaginative, then did exactly the same to some of his English prisoners, flinging three to their deaths off the side of a French-held mountain, while leaving those he merely blinded to shuffle pitiably back to Andelay. Each side in turn piously argued that the other was the first to display such barbaric behavior. The tit-for-tat bloodshed wasn't the end of it. Complicating Richard's ambitions, the land he wanted already had a manor house on it, belonging to the Archbishop of Rouen, Walter de Coutances. We've met de Coutances before. Just a few years ago, he'd stepped up to run the Crusader King's government after the detested Longchamp had been deposed. De Coutances had even served as a hostage in Germany for Richard's release. It's hard to grasp the seething disloyalty among the upper classes of the medieval world. It seems that no tie, whether of blood, religion, personal vow, treaty, or dedicated service, was enough to prevent men from offering the most insolent affronts to one another. Richard thought the archbishop's property the best place to put his fortress. When early negotiations to buy it stalled, Richard simply took it. The archbishop was naturally outraged, slapping an interdict on the whole of Normandy for Richard's arrogance. Chronicler Roger of Hoveden wrote of unburied bodies of the dead lying in the streets of Normandy's towns. Sorrowing families denied the comforts of this most basic Christian ritual, because a king was indifferent to the niceties of ownership when it came to something he wanted. The fight between king and archbishop would eventually settle down after papal intercession, Richard gifting the disgruntled archbishop with other properties, including rights to the revenues of the busy port of Dieppe. However, their quarrel was still quite unsettled when Richard started construction in 1196. His agents busily hired quarrymen, stonemasons, carpenters, lumbermen, blacksmiths, ditch diggers for the moats, engineers to do the calculations, boatmen and draymen, clerks and cooks, some 6,000 of them. It could easily take a decade for an ordinary nobleman to finance and build an ordinary castle. Immense Gaillard, filled with engineering inventions never seen before, would be finished in 2 years. It didn't come cheaply. Historians have calculated that Richard spent more on his beloved creation than he did throughout the rest of his reign for all his other castles combined. During his crusade, Richard had worked beside his soldiers to rebuild the walls of Ascalon. He didn't play mason himself this time, but he was at Andelay as often as he could be, squinting at the quality of the timber, pacing off the location of doorways, urging men to move faster and work harder. Chronicler William of Newburgh reported an ominous rain of blood falling from the skies one day, but even that wasn't allowed to delay construction. Indeed, Newburgh was moved to comment that if God himself had sent an angel to come down and order an end to the whole thing, the heavenly visitor would have found himself roundly cursed by the ferociously determined Richard. The locals must have watched it all with absolute astonishment, no doubt mingled with nationalistic pride. No one in the world had ever built anything like it. Richard so doted on the place that he affectionately nicknamed it My Daughter, and spent as much time there as he possibly could. His charters issued from its mighty walls were captioned De Bellum Castrum Derube, from the fair castle on the rock. Richard never wrote his autobiography, but if he had, he may well have counted Chateau Gaillard the greatest achievement of his life. By now, it was a life that had about 3 years left to it. He would spend them, as he had spent most of the others, always fighting, always looking for more money so he could fight again. But he did make stabs at diplomacy as the 12th century rounded into its last years. His ambassadors made appearances at every court that bordered Philip Augustus's world. A decade or two before, kings and princes across Europe had been proud to ally themselves with his father. Now they were most agreeable to treaties with Richard. Germany was particularly avid. Richard's former jailer turned friend, the Holy Roman Emperor Henry VI, was unexpectedly dead at the age of 31. He had been in Sicily at the time, some said poisoned, and departed this world leaving an imperial crown that was almost unique in Europe, by way of being elective, not hereditary. The Germans offered the honor to Lionheart. He turned it down, but messengers eventually clattered into Paris with word that the new emperor was Otto of Saxony, son of Henry the Lion and Matilda Plantagenet, thus Richard's nephew. Not only were Otto and Richard blood relatives, but Otto had spent a good deal of his boyhood with the Plantagenets, and genuinely liked and admired his uncle. It was a bitter shock to the French, who were becoming increasingly isolated, a shock magnified by the news that on his deathbed the emperor had released Richard from his vows of fealty and promised to return Richard's immense ransom. We should note that that might have been a compelling gesture from a dying man, but the Germans were to think better of it as time passed. It was never paid. But Otto's accession to the German throne yielded fevered speculation that Richard would now recognize Otto as his own heir, vaulting past the various troubles inherent in naming either his only remaining brother, notorious John Lackland, or his nephew Arthur of Brittany. Not only a child, but tainted by the fact that he was living, if not by choice, at Philip Augustus's court. There was more disturbing news for the French. Flanders, which liked to play the field, signed a new pact of friendship and support with the Plantagenets. It was a valuable alliance, since Flanders was a sought-after partner thanks to its looms and tough mercenary soldiers. Then Toulouse, that old enemy of Aquitaine, made peace to Richard's south, exchanging pledges of such weight that Richard's sister, widowed Joan Plantagenet, formerly Queen of Sicily, became the fourth of what would eventually be 6 wives of the fairly horrible Count of Toulouse. As a side note, she'd leave him in 2 years, and then die giving birth to a baby boy she named Richard. The little boy would not see his first birthday. Philip Augustus angrily attacked turncoat Flanders, only to find his army trapped in marshland. As the Flemish retreated toward the coast, the pursuing French stumbled into a featureless quagmire that literally sank the invaders. To avoid his own captivity, where he knew unpleasant prospects loomed, Philip had to agree to make peace. The two sides duly signed a new truce, this one containing a novel provision that if Richard were to die, his brother John could not make peace with France without Flemish approval. This obviously made much of Flanders, but it also implied that John had risen high in Richard's estimation. Was Lackland again Lionheart's heir? We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again April 7th for the next episode of Lion's Forge, available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.